Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
UN talks on Libya stall. Al-Shabaab militants attack a military base in southern Somalia. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila is having no part of foreign advice on his nation's electoral process. The AFP quotes Mr. Kabila as telling Parliament, "We are always ready to receive advice, guidance, and suggestions, but never injunctions." The president is under pressure from France and the United States to step down when his term in office ends in 2016. He was twice elected amid opposition accusations of election fraud and claims by foreign monitors that the votes lacked credibility. Reuters quotes a United Nations official in the Sahel region as saying talks between the warring factions in Libya have stalled. Special envoy Hirut Gebrselassie says several countries in the region face instability unless the situation is resolved. He said the political process is stagnant and that fighting among factions is ongoing. He warned of reports that the Islamic State group had begun setting up training camps in Libya. Reuters reports officials as saying Al-Shabaab militants today attacked a military base in southern Somalia. The officials say at least 10 soldiers were killed. Earlier this year, troops launched an operation to remove Al-Shabaab forces from their strongholds. An Al-Shabaab spokesman acknowledged that his group was behind the attack. Zimbabwe's new vice president is getting a chance to be in charge. President Robert Mugabe assigned Vice President Emmerson M. Mnangagwa to run things while he is on his annual vacation. This is VOA News. The AFP reports civil society volunteers have released a list of the names of people killed in the one-year-old South Sudanese civil war. The list includes people ranging from the age of 14 months to 105 years old. There is no official death toll in the conflict, but the unofficial list released today is believed to include only a fraction of the actual number killed. In a case that shocked the country, a Ugandan nanny has been sentenced to 4 years in jail for mistreating a toddler. The abuse of Jolly Tumahira was recorded in a video that was made public. A judge in Kampala said the crime was unjustifiable and inexcusable. The Northern Coalition for Democracy and Justice, a human rights group in Nigeria, today asked the International Criminal Court to bring charges against Nigerian presidential candidate Muhammadu Buhari for the post-election violence in 2011. Reuters reports that the activists say Buhari is implicated in the deaths of 800 people. Buhari's All Progressives Congress Party dismissed the claim as politically motivated. That was the sound today as a standoff in Sydney, Australia ended, that coming after police stormed the Lindt Chocolate Cafe in the city's central business district, where a man held at least a dozen people hostage for about 16 hours. There are unconfirmed reports of casualties. Several people were wheeled away from the scene on stretchers. Police identified the suspect as Iranian immigrant Manharan Monis, also known as Montagi Bourjoudi, linked to the killings of his wife, and known to have sent hateful letters to the families of Australian soldiers killed overseas. During the standoff, a black flag with the Islamic creed known as the Shahada could be seen through a glass window. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today. The pair met in Rome for the talks that lasted nearly 3 hours. The meeting came as Palestinian officials pushed for a U.N. resolution calling for an end to Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory within 2 years. Before the meeting, Mr. Netanyahu said he would not allow others to dictate a time frame for withdrawal. Reuters reports that three radical Israelis were charged today with setting fire to a school in Jerusalem known for its advocacy of Arab-Israeli coexistence. The three young men belong to Lahava, a group that objects to relations between Jews and Arabs. They are accused of setting fire to a classroom in the hand-in-hand school last month and writing anti-Arabic graffiti on the walls. I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, challenges are at several levels. I mean, at international level, we are still struggling to have the right amount of staff to go to the field. Then at the field level, we're still facing the same challenges. They might not be exactly of the same scale in some places, but challenges are some of the population still needs to understand exactly the risk and the transmission problem, and we are dealing with very heavy tradition in this part of Africa.
That's Benoit Macha Carpentier, Senior Media Officer of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, speaking on the persistent challenges they are faced fighting the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the World Health Organization updated figures today on the Ebola epidemic. It indicates 18,464 cases with 6,841 deaths so far.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization says diagnostic tests that could more rapidly and simply detect the Ebola virus are being developed. The WHO and partner agencies believe some of these new tests will be available for use in West Africa in the next few months. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
It now takes between 9 hours and 4 days to get confirmation of a suspected case of Ebola in West Africa. By any measure, this is too long because the virus spreads quickly and the possibility of more infections occurring while waiting for the test results is all too likely. Health agencies agree there's an urgent need for innovative ways to provide rapid, sensitive, safe, and simple testing for Ebola. The World Health Organization says progress may not be as fast as some would like, but progress is being made. Dr. Francis Moussi is focusing on Ebola diagnostics at WHO. He tells VOA two types of tests are being considered.
The rapid pregnancy type of test, that may take about 15 minutes, and the other ones based on nucleic acid technology, so the genetic material or the virus, and those tests may take maybe around 1 hour. And this second category of tests will probably be more sensitive, will be able to pick up the virus more easily.
WHO, Doctors Without Borders, and the private organization, the Foundation of Innovative New Diagnostics, are working with a number of companies to develop the tests and review them in record time. FIND Chief Scientific Officer Mark Perkins says field trials for one of the diagnostic tests will begin in February. He says the trials are likely to take place in either Sierra Leone or Guinea.
So we'd be looking primarily at how implementable, how usable these such tests would be. How easy is it? How much training was required? How feasible is it to implement these outside biosafety level laboratories, etc.? Those are trials I think that will be relatively brief. We imagine spending 2 to 4 weeks on such studies.
There are 19 mobile laboratories in the three Ebola-hit countries in West Africa. Three more labs soon will be deployed. WHO says there are plans to move smaller, more flexible lab facilities closer to where the patients live. This, it says, will enable people to quickly know whether or not they have tested positive for Ebola. If that is the case, then treatment for the disease can begin quickly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. The Ebola Response Team of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, IFRC, and its partners have been working in West Africa since the beginning of the Ebola outbreak to contain the disease and teach communities how to prevent the spread of the virus. However, the IFRC says many challenges remain as people continue to disregard life-saving instructions and information. Almost 11,000 Red Cross volunteers have stepped up to help end the Ebola outbreak, but there is still a lack of resources as health workers continue to be stigmatized. Benoit Macha Carpentier is a senior media officer for the IFRC in Geneva. He spoke with me about the challenges that still plague response teams.
Well, challenges are at several levels. I mean, at international level, we are still struggling to have the right amount of staff to go to the field. So we have regular training for people once a week now in Geneva, and we do have also trainings in Spain and in France. So these trainings are well attended, but we're still looking for more people so that we can sustain our response in the field in the treatment center that we have, one in Sierra Leone, and the French Red Cross has one in Guinea. So that's one point. Then at the field level, we're still facing the same challenges. They might not be exactly of the same scale in some places, but challenges are some of the population still needs to understand exactly the risk and the transmission problem. And we are dealing with very heavy traditions in this part of Africa. So it's been going on for now almost 9-10 months, and we're still facing this problem because now we've had the first phase of what we call global social mobilization at national level, which worked quite well. So it's TV and radio and posters and all this. Now we are talking about community engagement, really going to the communities individually, to each houses, to make sure that people understand the messages that you're giving, that they are going to take precautions, that they will report cases when it happens, that they will not hide any person that died because of fear of stigma. So it's all this work that needs to be done.
With attitudes and traditions being a big challenge in the fight with Ebola, what has been the response of volunteers and workers going door to door to inform people?
We've had about 11,000 volunteers involved in the response since March this year, and they've been playing a key role. I don't think we would be anywhere near where we are now if they had not been there, because they are coming from the communities, they are from the same areas, they share the same traditions, they understand them better, and people also trust them more. So it's easier for them to go in the communities, to knock on the door and to explain to people, because people will trust them. Doesn't mean that there's no resistance, because we're talking about very sensitive issues. We're talking about, you know, sometimes dead bodies, and we need to make sure that people handle them with care and in a safe manner. So it's very sensitive, even for people of the same tradition, but still goes much more easily with people you trust than if it was anyone from outside.
What is the immediate goal at this time in terms of containing the disease? I know you all have been doing the door-to-door campaigning. What is the next step? What is the immediate goal?
Our response is based on what we call five pillars: social mobilization and community engagement. It's contact tracing and monitoring, meaning finding the people that have been potentially in contact with infected people and monitoring them for the 21 days incubation period. Then there is the clinical case management, so that's where you take care of people, and the psychosocial support. And the last is the safe and dignified burials, which is one of the most important activity on the fight against Ebola. If you scale up, you need to scale them, all of them at the same time. So if you do a very good social mobilization and the message goes through very well, so people go to the health center or to the treatment center where they could get care, and then there's no bed or there's no capacity, then you've lost your battle, because you're sending people to a place that doesn't exist or that is understaffed or that doesn't have the capacity to host you. So you need to have all these pillars working at the same level all the time.
Your organization passed a resolution, and I'm going to quote your general secretary, who said the resolution is to isolate the disease without isolating the countries affected. So what exactly does this mean, and how will this be carried out?
It's more of a recommendation we're making. There's a big stigmatization and a big Ebola around the world. I mean, we used to say that there are two outbreaks. There's an outbreak of Ebola and one of fear and panic. And we need to fight that, because this is counterproductive and this is hampering our response. The fact that there is stigma means that we have less staff going to Ebola countries for responding to them. So that's valid for, you know, international, European, American staff, or for even African staff that are stigmatized when they are there, or the family are scared, and then they're stigmatized when they go back home. So that's one of the main things. And for now, I mean, we need to make sure that we don't isolate the countries, because if you're in a country that has already Ebola and all the economical impact of Ebola in the country, and you're closing the country completely, meaning there's no economic exchange between the neighboring countries, and the countries are not going to be self-sufficient to be able to resist to that. So the prices are going to go up. People are not going to be able to buy whatever goods that they used to buy because the prices are going up. So you're creating another problem by closing down the borders and isolating these countries. There are precautions measures that can be taken, but we must not isolate them and close everything.
That was Benoit Macha-Carpentier, Senior Media Officer for the IFRC. He spoke with me from Geneva.
The World Health Organization has released updated figures today on the Ebola epidemic. It says there have been 18,464 cases and 6,841 deaths so far. Also today, a Liberian hospital has started treating Ebola patients with the blood of Ebola survivors. Doctors at Elwa Hospital in Monrovia have begun injections of serum therapy. They expect to have enough blood serum to serve more than 20,000 patients by early next year. The treatment has been used in combination with other experimental treatments on Ebola patients evacuated to the United States and Britain and on a few infected Liberian healthcare workers. Meanwhile, Liberia has postponed its Senate elections until Friday in the hope that another delay will improve the credibility of elections in the midst of the Ebola crisis. The Supreme Court on Saturday ruled the vote must go forward.
The death toll from Friday's boat accident on Lake Tanganyika stands at nearly 130, but DRC authorities fear it could go much higher. They say at least 500 people were on board the MV Mutambala at the time of the accident. The privately operated vessel was sailing from coastal towns in Katanga province to South Kivu province. The cause of the sinking is not yet known, although many boats on the lake are often overcrowded. At least 200 people survived the accident.
A new report says civilians in northern Ivory Coast have become the targets of relentless and often violent attacks by criminals. Human Rights Watch says security forces have failed to protect the population and have not investigated the crimes that include beatings and at least four killings. Felicity Thompson is a consultant and researcher for Human Rights Watch. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about the situation in northern Ivory Coast.
I just finished a research mission to the north of Côte d'Ivoire, and I spoke with more than 40 people who told us of terrifying attacks regularly occurring on vehicles in roads in the northern part of the country. We spoke with bus drivers, with farmers, with market women, all of whom said they were afraid to move about. They're afraid to travel with money to buy merchandise, afraid to go pay their children's school fees. Numerous victims told us they lived in fear of this violence and robberies along the roads. It's a situation where you have numbers of armed men with Kalashnikov rifles stepping out onto the road and ordering drivers to pull over, at which point they will systematically rob everybody on board, and oftentimes witnesses reported to us that they would beat the driver and passengers also.
Do you know who's responsible?
The people that we spoke with, witnesses, local authorities, most of them believed that this phenomenon of armed attacks is due to former combatants. There is believed to be over 43,000 former combatants in Ivory Coast, and this number has yet to be disarmed and reintegrated into civilian life. A lot of people believe that the slow pace of this disarmament is really what's contributing to this situation in the north, where you have a proliferation of arms, large numbers of unemployed former combatants in the area, and also security forces who are not equipped to deal with the scale of the problem.
How about police? Are they available to handle this?
In Ivory Coast, you have police within the municipalities, and then you have gendarmes in the rural areas. I spoke with numerous police and gendarmes in the north who are very frustrated because they don't have the equipment or the means to respond quickly to these armed attacks. I spoke with gendarmes who told me they have one vehicle per sector, and some sectors have no vehicles at all. On the other hand, many victims and witnesses have said that security forces are often unwilling to respond to attacks in progress or even to investigate reports of attacks. Many victims told us they'd given up reporting attacks altogether.
Are there any particular areas of the north where these attacks are being concentrated?
It really is a widespread phenomenon. Attacks are occurring on the main highways, north of Yamoussoukro to Bouaké, north of Bouaké towards the Malian and Burkinabe borders, and also on the smaller secondary roads in and around Bouaké City and across the northern zones.
Now, besides the actual attacks, you're also saying that many victims say they're falling ill from what they describe as stress. Can you tell us about that?
It sounds very much like sort of PTSD. One victim, for example, who was involved in a multi-vehicle attack on a main highway in the north, she told me that on arrival to her destination in the north, she couldn't leave her room for 3 days.
Now, you've made a number of recommendations. Can you talk about how the government should respond to the criminality in the north?
The state has an obligation to protect its population from aggression. And in the short term, we're calling on the government to establish a highly trained special security unit in Bouaké that can be tasked with responding to criminality in the north. We're also calling on them to increase the equipment and the personnel and vehicles of security forces, police and gendarme in the north, so they can respond properly and ensure that they do respond. We're asking the government to set up a hotline so that people can report attacks and security forces can respond quickly. And finally, we are asking that the government ensure the judicial system in the northern zones has the capacity and resources to investigate and try attackers. We've only seen a handful of convictions so far this year. There is an environment of impunity that is allowing these attacks to continue.
Felicity Thompson is a consultant and researcher for Human Rights Watch. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The World Health Organization's updated figures on the Ebola epidemic indicates 18,464 cases with 6,841 deaths so far. And the death toll from Friday's boat accident on Lake Tanganyika stands at nearly 130, but DRC authorities fear it could go much higher. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Washington, D.C., 20237.
A Uganda judge has sentenced a maid in Kampala to 4 years in prison for beating and kicking an 18-month-old child in her care. The case achieved wide publicity through video surveillance used as evidence in court and seen by thousands on the internet. The child's parents suspected 22-year-old Jolly Tumuhiwe was abusing their daughter while they were at work. They installed a video camera in the house to secure evidence. Tumuhiwe originally pleaded guilty to torture, but the charge was later reduced to abuse. The video shows the maid throwing the child to the floor several times, sitting on her, kicking her, and dragging her unconscious from the room.
United Nations aid workers say 1 year after violence broke out in South Sudan, millions of people remain in dire need of humanitarian assistance, especially food aid. They say they need nearly $2 billion U.S. dollars to help the growing number of South Sudanese people in need. VOA's Charlton Doki reports.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, estimates 6.4 million South Sudanese will be at risk of food insecurity 6 months from now as the two warring parties fail to reach a peace deal and fighting continues in parts of the country. According to UN OCHA's latest report, aid agencies will require $1.8 billion to help a little more than 4 million South Sudanese. Following a three-day visit to South Sudan late last month, Kyung Wakang, the UN's Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, said they needed $600 million by mid-February to pre-position relief supplies, repair badly damaged roads and airstrips that were flooded during the just-ended rainy season.
Funding that comes now will save more lives. And I appeal to humanitarian donor organizations to stay the course to continue to fund us. The funding must be sustained to meet the great need to preposition during the dry season.
According to the UN, the year-long conflict has already displaced more than 1.9 million people from their homes, including more than 1.4 million internally displaced people who are still living in camps. In addition, 472,000 South Sudanese have sought refuge in neighboring Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and more than 100,000 others have taken refuge at UN bases across South Sudan. UN OCHA says some 500,000 other vulnerable people are stuck in rural parts of Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile, where they are inaccessible by aid workers. Toby Lanza, the head of UN humanitarian operations in South Sudan, says even though aid workers helped avert a famine this year, millions of South Sudanese will be at risk in the coming year.
Despite the fact that this is the time of the harvest, there are twice as many people who are severely food insecure, twice as many as would normally be the case. As we go into the dry season, there are fears that there will be more violence. There are fears that the lean season will grip harder.
Lanza says the UN plans to provide aid to the most vulnerable, as well as improve the self-reliance and coping capacities of communities whose means of livelihood have been all but destroyed during the conflict.
And so this is something that we will be watching very closely. We will work closely with the authorities of this country to monitor the situation and to do everything we possibly can to reach as many people in need, and also to pre-position aid to make sure that when the rains return next May, we will be able to continue to help people if they remain in need.
But Kang warns that humanitarians can only do much when the warring parties refuse to compromise and reach a peace agreement.
Humanitarians will work hard to continue helping the most vulnerable, but we will never be able to keep up as the conflict continues to generate more people in need, more displacements.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately, because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A Liberian hospital is treating Ebola patients with the blood of Ebola survivors. The death toll from Friday's boat accident on Lake Tanganyika stands at nearly 130, but DRC authorities fear it could go much higher. And Human Rights Watch says security forces have failed to protect the population in Ivory Coast. Coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia. And in our feature segment, journalists in Zimbabwe face draconian media laws that criminalize their work. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with European club football.
Kim, the draw was held Monday for the round of 16 in the UEFA Champions League, Europe's premier club football competition. Three of the eight home and away series are repeats from last season. Reigning European champion Real Madrid of Spain will meet Schalke of Germany. Barcelona of Spain will play Manchester City of England. And Chelsea of England will challenge Paris Saint-Germain of France. In the round of 16 last season, Real Madrid crushed Schalke 9-2 on aggregate, while Barcelona beat Man City 4-1. And in the quarterfinals, Chelsea eliminated PSG on the away goals rule. In the five other round of 16 matchups from Monday's draw, Bayer Leverkusen of Germany will go against Atletico Madrid, which lost to Real Madrid 4-1 in extra time in last season's all-Spanish final. Juventus of Italy is matched against 2013 finalist Borussia Dortmund of Germany. 2013 winner Bayern Munich of Germany will play Shakhtar Donetsk of Ukraine. Arsenal of England will go against Monaco of France. And Porto of Portugal will play Swiss club FC Basel. The first leg matches will be played February 17th and 18th and February 24th and 25th. And the second leg matches will be held March 10th and 11th and March 17th and 18th. Meanwhile, European champion Real Madrid will meet Cruz Azul of Mexico Tuesday in the first semifinal at the FIFA Club World Cup in Marrakesh, Morocco. San Lorenzo of Argentina, the favorite football club of Pope Francis, will surely be looking for some blessed results when it plays Auckland City of New Zealand in the second semifinal on Wednesday. Auckland City eliminated Africa's two representatives, as we hear now from the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot, on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. Africa's two clubs in this year's FIFA Club World Cup have been eliminated from the title quest. African champion AS Setif of Algeria and the Moroccan club Maghreb Tetouan were both defeated by the same team, Auckland City, the Oceanian champion. On Saturday, the New Zealand club beat AS Setif 1-0 to reach the semi-finals for the first time. John Arvin's second-half strike gave his club a stunning North African double. Auckland City, which is making a record sixth appearance at the tournament, had beaten Moroccan club Maghreb Tetouan on penalties in their preliminary round clash on Wednesday. Auckland will now face San Lorenzo of Argentina, the South American champion, in a semi-final in Marrakesh on Wednesday. The FIFA Club World Cup is contested annually by continental champions, plus the host nation's national champion. Morocco is hosting the tournament for the second year running, on the basis of which Maghreb Tetouan qualified to play. The Moroccan club's defeat has already forced its coach, Aziz El Amri, to resign. Amri, who is 64, stepped down 3 days after Tetouan lost on penalties to Auckland City in a quarter-final playoff. Tetouan failed to match the performance of fellow Moroccan club Raja Casablanca, which went all the way to the final of the tournament when Morocco hosted the FIFA Club World Cup last year. Raja lost 2-0 to German club Bayern Munich in the final of last year's competition. Let's recall that in 2010, another African team, TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo, made it all the way to the final, where it lost by 3 goals to Italian giant Inter Milan. Now, all the 7 participants in the ongoing FIFA Club World Cup will return home with some prize money. The winner gets $5 million, runner-up $4 million, and the third place winner, $2.5 million. Also, the team that finishes fourth gets $2 million, fifth place $1.5 million, sixth place $1 million, and the last $500,000. Turning to the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, one of the 16 finalists, Cameroon, will begin its preparations for the tournament with a squad get together in Yaoundé on January 5th, according to official sources. The Indomitable Lions will spend 3 days training in the capital and will also take on the Democratic Republic of Congo in a friendly. The team will then move on to Libreville in Gabon for another training camp from January 8th to 16th. The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, which will be the 30th edition of the 2-yearly football extravaganza, will run from January 17th to February 8th in Equatorial Guinea. Cameroon is in Group D of the tournament, where it will face Mali on January 20th, Guinea on January 24th, and the Ivory Coast on January 28th. The Indomitable Lions will play all their first-round games in Equatorial Guinea's capital, Malabo. Equatorial Guinea was picked as hosts after Morocco backed out due to Ebola fears. Meanwhile, retired Indomitable Lions star Samuel Eto'o may have his 12-month contract at English Premiership club Everton extended. His agents will be in England over Christmas to hold talks. The deal signed by the striker upon his arrival at Everton as a free agent over the summer included a clause which can be activated once he has completed 15 games. With the Cameroon international having shown that he can be an important figure in Everton's plans, with 4 goals and 2 assists in his 15 appearances in all competitions, all sides are now keen to gather at the negotiating table. Roberto Martinez has previously admitted that he would like to keep the 33-year-old past the end of the current campaign. In October, the Spaniard said, quote, "It's natural he will get another year," unquote. There are now only a few formalities left to be tied up. The former Barcelona star has scored 4 goals in 14 appearances spread across Premier League, Europa League, and League Cup competition. In other news, Liverpool striker Mario Balotelli has accepted a charge of making racist and anti-Semitic comments on social media. The charge was made by the English Football Association. Balotelli was charged a week ago after he posted a controversial image of computer game character Super Mario on Instagram. The image included a message, "Don't be racist, be like Mario. He's an Italian plumber created by Japanese people who speaks English and looks like a Mexican, jumps like a black man, and grabs coin like a Jew." Balotelli's offense was deemed by the FA to be an aggravated breach, as it included a reference to ethnic origin, color, race, nationality, or religion. The 24-year-old has not requested a personal hearing, but has instead submitted written mitigation in the hope of persuading the FA to give him a fine instead of a suspension. The minimum ban for a race-related on-pitch offense is 5 matches, but that would not apply in a case such as Balotelli's, for which no specific punishments are outlined. The player apologized for the posting last week, writing on Twitter, "I apologize if I've offended anyone. The post was meant to be anti-racist with humor. I now understand that out of context, it may have the opposite effect." Balotelli deleted the offensive post after it was criticized. But according to FA guidelines, deleting an inappropriate posting, while advisable, does not necessarily prevent disciplinary action being taken.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Philippine boxing legend Manny Pacquiao vowed to chase Floyd Mayweather into ring submission after his U.S. rival offered to fight him next year in a blockbuster world title face-off. Pacquiao, who is 36, says Mayweather has reached a dead end and he has nowhere to run but to fight him. He spoke to the French news agency AFP on Saturday, hours after the undefeated Mayweather issued a May 2nd challenge on U.S. television. The two were longtime rivals as the best pound-for-pound boxers of their generation. But the dream fight has never materialized to the disappointment of the boxing world. Speaking to Showtime Sports in the U.S. on Friday night, Mayweather, who is 37, said he wants his next fight to be against the Filipino star. However, The Americans said the expected richest fight in boxing history will only happen if he receives a much bigger share of the purse than his opponent. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
In pro basketball news, the Golden State Warriors remain the NBA's hottest club. The Warriors won their club record 16th consecutive game Sunday night, beating the host New Orleans Pelicans 128-122 in overtime. Sharpshooting guard Stephen Curry scored 8 of his 34 points in the overtime period, while teammate Klay Thompson added 29 points for the Warriors, who have the NBA's best record at 21 wins and 2 losses. In other action Sunday night, Los Angeles Lakers star Kobe Bryant surpassed Michael Jordan for third place on the NBA scoring list. Kobe scored 26 points in a 100-94 victory over the host Minnesota Timberwolves, including a three-point shot with just over a minute to play that sealed the win. Carl the Mailman Malone and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, both now retired, are the only people ahead of Kobe on the NBA's all-time scoring chart. Elsewhere around the NBA, the Oklahoma City Thunder storm past the Phoenix Suns 112-88 for their sixth consecutive victory. Russell Westbrook had 28 points, 8 assists, and 8 rebounds for the Thunder, while Kevin Durant, who won the NBA's Most Valuable Player Award last season, added 23 points and 8 rebounds. And let's not forget my beloved Washington Wizards, playing just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters. The Wizards wave their wands once again, beating the Utah Jazz 93-84 for their fourth straight victory. The Wizards improved their record to 17 wins and 6 losses. On Friday night, the Wizards beat the Los Angeles Clippers 104-96 right here in Washington to snap the 9-game winning streak of the Clippers. Go Wizards! I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, journalists in Zimbabwe facing draconian media laws that criminalize their work. And next, scientists making rapid advances in studies of genetic variations. But first, some music. Here is Chachi of Ethiopia with One Day.
Talking about the day we've been all waiting for ya. Zion away.
One day all my people will be free. One day we break the bonds of mental slavery. No more living in poverty. No more corruption. No more misery. No more worry about you and me. One day our children will dance and sing. Freedom bell ring, let freedom bell ring, let freedom bell ring. mental slavery. No more living in poverty. No more corruption. No more misery. No more worry about you and me. One day our children will dance and sing. One day our elders will shout and chant.
When Babylon will have to burn, no more wickedness, yo. Better than now. No worries, no suffering, no more sorrow. Only good vibes are flow, yo. In the promised land, the place called Zion. No religion, no class, no segregation. Where righteousness prolong, the ultimate plan. Give praises to the conquering lion, yeah. Shot no bust on that day, no way. Nobody no fuss on that day, no way. Children no cry on that day, no way. All who have wings are gonna fly away.
Ethiopia's Chachi with One Day.
Well, in Zimbabwe, journalists say the environment in which they operate remains littered with obstacles, including archaic or draconian media laws that criminalize their work. Lorda Moyo reports from Harare.
Journalists in Zimbabwe continue to operate at great risk of being arrested, with media houses under the constant threat of being closed down or sued by the government, which is failing to align the country's media laws and the constitution, a recent media workshop in Mutare revealed. Scribes say they face obstacles on a daily basis, in particular restrictive media laws of the Official Secrets Act, the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, AIPA, the Public Order and Security Act, POSA, and the Broadcasting Services Act. Media practitioners are campaigning for self-regulation as opposed to state control, arguing other professionals like medical doctors and lawyers also self-regulate. Tarea Wungwe, chairperson of Mutare's pioneering community radio station, known as Kumakomo Community Radio Station, says he is more worried about the state dilly-dallying on the issue of registering new players in the broadcasting sector.
Yes, as a volunteer of this initiative in Mutare, we have the problem that it is taking us long to be registered. So we are trying to work towards the process whereby we get licensed and we operate freely as a community radio station for the people of Mutare. So far, up to now, there is not even a single community radio station which is registered. This has seen our projects stalling in the sense that we are not able to move with the pace that we had targeted. From the time we started as an initiative up to now, we were hoping that by now we would be out there operating for the people of Mutare.
Wungwe says a lot needs to be done to force the government to expedite the licensing of community radio stations. He says opening up of the airwaves will create employment opportunities for thousands of jobless college graduates.
Impossible because of the laws which are not permitting us to be registered. We were getting assurances that maybe in the coming parliamentary season they will be able to license the community radios. Maybe they will be able to make the calls for the community radios. So we are placing ourselves in a position whereby we are trying to mobilize and advocate for support for community radio stations such that we have membership in all the ones in this province, in this city. These ward committees are also helping us to lobby for support for community radios, but we are doing it in a way that is acceptable to the laws of this country, in the sense that we are able to apply for a clearance to hold our meetings, and we get cleared. So the management of our radio station is telling us that if we keep working towards the license, following this legal route, we'll be able to get the license. But what we're saying is that maybe if the government can speed up the process so that at least we know where we're going.
Kenneth Matimati, a freelance journalist based in the Eastern Border City, says he's worried that pieces of legislation like AIPA that inhibit free access to information from the government departments and institutions remain on the statute books. This, he adds, forces some journalists to speculate on matters, resulting in them being either arrested or facing litigation.
Well, the issue of decriminalization of media practitioners is a very sensitive issue, because I think it's an aspect that falls under the arm of several interrelated restrictive laws that we have pertaining access to information, which I think is the major aspect, because when journalists have unlimited access to information, you find that there are no aspects whereby journalists are criminalized on issues relating to unbalanced or articles that are perceived to have been written in a malicious way. So I think the most important to give journalists unlimited access to information.
Matimati says journalists have a critical role to play in society, hence criminalizing their operations is tantamount to muzzling the press.
On the aspect of decriminalization, I don't think we should continue moving forward with that policy in place. Issues to do with the media, these issues should be handled on a civil matter, not criminalized.
Tabani Moyo, an advocacy officer with the Media Institute of Southern Africa, Mr. Zimbabwe, says his organization will continue to work with other groups and media houses in the country in lobbying lawmakers to decriminalize media laws in the country. Reporting in Mutare, this is Leda Moyo.
In recent years, scientists have been making rapid advances in studies of genetic variations in European and East Asian populations. Now, as we hear from reporter R. Chimes, populations in Africa, the cradle of the human race, are getting the same treatment.
The African Genome Variation Project set out to discover more about how variations in DNA can help in understanding patterns of disease, ultimately leading to better treatments. Writing with colleagues in the journal Nature, senior author Manjinder Sandhu of Britain's Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute describes the project. Working with other institutions, including partners throughout Africa, the Genome Variation Project has collected and analyzed genetic information from nearly 3,000 individuals, representing the diversity of the African experience over many millennia. In fact, Sandhu says that in the DNA, you can find traces of the movement of people who originated in Africa, migrated elsewhere, and returned.
It's a mass population movement from out of Africa. Populations have returned over thousands of years and mixed with population groups, and you see vestiges of those signals in the human genomes of modern Africans today.
For example, genetic characteristics of Eurasian people were found in today's West Africans. Sandhu says the Genome Variation Project may help explain why certain genetic variations make some people more likely than others to develop specific diseases.
And ultimately, if we understand the biological processes underlying those diseases, we can start thinking about how we can develop new medicines or use existing medicines to help combat and control those diseases.
In a commentary also published in Nature, Raj Ramasar of the University of Cape Town points out that as more African genomes are analyzed, it will open a larger window into human diversity, evolution, and disease susceptibility. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of inexpensive, reliable energy delivery is one of the chief obstacles to growth and development in much of Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. Yet today, nearly 70% of sub-Saharan Africans lack access to electricity. This despite the fact that the region has tremendous energy resources, ranging from geothermal, solar, wind, and hydropower to significant reserves of natural gas. That is why last year, President Barack Obama announced Power Africa, a public-private initiative led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, that will significantly increase generation and distribution of power in sub-Saharan Africa. In the 16 months since its launch, Power Africa's partnerships with African governments, private investors, other donors, and developers have already begun to bring benefits to the people of Africa, said USAID's Eric Postel, assistant to the administrator for Africa. The Power Africa initiative helps governments identify the reasons why projects to improve electricity generation and distribution are lagging and works with them to remove the obstacles as they are identified. Power Africa also works with the private sector to help companies invest in power generation and distribution. Power Africa has already helped to financially close deals that will generate more than 3,000 megawatts, which has the potential to provide power for more than 5 million African homes, service providers, and businesses, said Mr. Postel. Generating sufficient power is one part of the equation. Delivering it to those who need it is another. Only 18.3% of people living in rural communities in sub-Saharan Africa have access to electricity, compared to 55.5% of urban dwellers. That is why Power Africa launched Beyond the Grid, a competition for innovative solutions that develop, scale up, or extend the use of proven technologies for off-grid energy. Today, 600 million Africans do not have access to electricity. Hospitals cannot function optimally. Businesses cannot open and children cannot read after dark. Food rots before it makes it to market, said Mr. Postel. But it does not have to be this way. Together with our partners in the U.S. Congress, Africa, other donor nations, and private businesses, Power Africa is working to greatly increase access to reliable, cleaner energy in Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello. I want to take a few moments to speak directly to you, the people of West Africa. On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola. Along with our partners around the world, the United States is working with your governments to help stop this disease. Stopping this disease won't be easy, but we know how to do it. Together, we can treat those who are sick with respect and dignity. We can save lives. and our countries can work together to improve public health so this kind of outbreak doesn't happen again. In this urgent work and in building a stronger and more prosperous Africa, you'll continue to have a partner in me and in the United States of America.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.